Monocle on Sunday is brought to you in association with Zurich Tourism.
Good morning. We're live in Zurich. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up today, Switzerland takes major steps in reopening the country. My guests, Florian Egli, Juliet Lindley and Rob Cox, will discuss Bern's successful campaign against COVID-19 whilst protecting its position as a hub for global corporate HQs and UN agencies. Also ahead.
Hello, I am James Chambers, Monocle's bureau chief in Hong Kong. I'll be talking later on about the local reactions to Donald Trump's announcement on Friday to revoke Hong Kong's special trade status.
Thank you, James. We'll also hear from our editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle 24's own Tom Edwards looks at the strengths of radio in times like these.
If it's done right, radio offers something no other medium can deliver. A spellbinding combination of immediacy, intimacy, and humanity.
Too right, Tom. It's Sunday, the 31st of May, live from Dufourstrasse here in Zurich. This is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday with Tyler Brulé.
Indeed. Good morning from the heart of a very, very sunny Seefeld. I am Tyler Brulé. I'm here with Juliet Lindley, Rob Cox, and I'm here also with Florian Egli, who's going to be scolded because just before we went on air, he just took his whole green tea or whatever it was and he dumped it all over the table, almost scorching and ruining Juliet's jeans. But anyway, we're all here. Juliet, good morning. We're going to ignore Florian right now until he pulls himself
together. It was beautiful Americano.
Oh, was it Americano? Even better. Anyway, at least we have black felt on this table. Juliet, how are you this morning?
I'm so well, thank you. Beautiful day. Sun is shining. A little bit of breeze, as you said, coming in on my bicycle today. But, you know, on our front, it's kind of nice because as of next week, our children get the beautiful gift of being able to go back full time to school every day. Not that it's a parent's gift. It's just for the children, clearly.
Clearly. Absolutely. Rob, you're about to wing it out of this country. You're heading back to a very calm, placid United States at the moment. I'm looking at the monitors behind the table here, and as you can see, it's a
sort of mixture of dread and excitement that propels me back. I mean, I have to go and bring my son back as well, and who's been here for the whole of lockdown.
We should say though, your son is old enough to go back on his own.
He is. Right? He's a full 22. I mean, at least by numbers, he should be. And it's time to go back. Lots of things to do, but I expect to be there for a couple of weeks, but part of me, certainly with great trepidation, I look at the headlines, I look at the just absolutely horrifying images from cities across the country, and that is hard to take. At the same time, I'm looking forward to seeing what it's like to get on an airplane because it's been precisely 83 days that I've slept in the same bed, which is not normal for someone as itinerant as I am. But it should be quite interesting, and I certainly will report back to you, Tyler, because I know you have a keen interest in all of that.
Also, our listener, I think we're going to have to be checking in with you once you're over there as well. People are going to be missing you on a Sunday, Rob. Okay, Florian, you got a second coffee already, so that means you're back in the good book somehow, some way. We were hoping to sort of have you last week, but you were up in the Berner Oberland or somewhere. Or was it the week before last, maybe? Anyway, you escaped to the mountains.
Yeah. I did so frequently. I mean, if travel is interrupted and you can't go anywhere anymore, then you get to know your own country, I guess. So I've actually been hiking a lot. I've bought a mountain bike, so I've joined the ranks of downhill mountain bikers now. I've been kind of out there quite often. And other than that, I think life in Zurich is slowly getting back to normal. I was having an apéro yesterday, which felt like it actually never stopped. So it kind of life is getting back to normal a little bit, but I still struggle, I have to say, to kind of get really back to normal life and all the social interactions that we're used to.
Like hugging and kissing people when you see them.
Yeah,
at the
exactly.
Apéro.
So even here, when we arrived here, like it's still a bit awkward. Like
Juliet's so trying to throw a hug with everybody, right? So. Anyway, I believe our editor, Andrew Tuck, is also in London this morning. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning. And lots of hugging going on, I hear.
Well, that's good. Just Juliet. I mean, you know what Juliet's like. I mean, you've been exposed.
So antiseptic, you'd never catch me hugging anyone.
And was it the shock of that that made Florian throw his coffee in the air then?
It could have been that. He sort of jumped back, like, what's going on? Andrew, how are things? I'm looking at images a little bit earlier anyway on the BBC of gatherings in the park. And as you wrote yesterday in Monocle Weekend, the Saturday edition, a lot of things are getting back into the groove. And I think just as Florian was saying, but there is a sort of odd moment right now that many people are in. You know, what are you supposed to do? And then I guess there's this funny sort of underlay or overlay of also guidelines as well that, you know, we're seeing. And there was a very strange piece written on the BBC's website yesterday, which talked about how to invite people over for a garden party. So, Rob, we're going to come back to this because Rob is having a barbecue today, Andrew, and I'm sure he would invite you if you were here. But it was quite strange. It was all of these rules about, you know, how do you flush the toilet? How do you bring people through your house, etc. And I'm wondering, I guess, and this is maybe can be a bit of a theme for today's show, are we almost overdoing it in a way? Do we have to move to a place that just we have to allow people to use some degree of common sense?
Well, it's such a complicated picture here because, first of all, we do have some changes that kick in on Monday, which are you can now meet with six people socially distanced in a park or an outdoor setting, so in your garden. They're not supposed to come through your house. But I think that because the government lost control of the whole agenda here last week with this story about Dominic Cummings, a government advisor who broke all the rules, that actually people are just making up as they go along for themselves now. So just speaking casually to people, you know, this weekend, people were going to go to birthday parties and sit in people's gardens this weekend already ahead of Monday. People are like, well, if it's okay for the government to kind of make up the rules on the go, we can do the same. So there's definitely a sense that something has changed in the last few days. As you know, we have the dog, so park every day. And yesterday in the park, groups of like eight guys playing football together, supposedly not allowed, but no police around anymore. And nobody looking askance. The only thing is that it's interesting how many people are wearing masks in London as opposed to elsewhere. And that is because we still have this ridiculously high rate of infection. 8,000 cases every day. That's not counting hospitals or people in care. So it's a huge number. And if you think that 1% is the fatality rate, that means even in 3 weeks' time, 4 weeks' time, we'll be having like 80 people a day dying in the UK. Unless they can get the R rate down. So it's a hell of a long way to go for the UK. And that's why you can see countries like Greece saying, actually, as we open up for tourism, the UK will not be on the list of people welcome.
Andrew, just when we look at that picture right now, I feel a little bit that almost the government doesn't want to talk about these daily numbers. I mean, they are there in the briefing, but they're not as front and center as they used to be. And is that also because it creates a bit of a complicated picture on one side? And I think that's certainly been, and I haven't seen a lot of the paper, the Sunday papers this morning out of the UK, but you know, you have a government divided in the UK right now. On one side, people saying, you know, you need to take, you know, step by step, or even maybe slow down. And then of course you have the Chancellor and many others saying, look, we have to get this economy going. There are going to be, unfortunately, numbers and there are going to be deaths along the way. Regardless, though, the country needs to open up. And is that also part of the complicated picture you have in the UK right now?
Completely. You know, the economy is just beginning to get going again here, and they're desperate not to shut it down again. And they're panicked about how long this furlough scheme can go on and what happens at the end of that, how many millions of people will be unemployed. They're putting these ridiculous rules on restaurants and shops as they reopen, which means many people are saying, look, we're not going to reopen because if we did that and took our staff off furlough, we would go bust within a couple of weeks. You know, pubs saying, how do you have a country pub with even more than five people in it if everybody has to be 2 meters away from each other? It's just not possible. Okay, maybe in these warm summer months, but as winter hits, that isn't going to happen either. So there is this tension. And, you know, I think for ordinary people, like me, and I include myself in that, you have to be very careful about looking at the newspapers here because you go onto any of the sites and you can read, sunshine means that coronavirus is burning out at a faster rate than expected. the R rate outside, if you discount hospitals, could be as low as 0.5. SAGE, the people who advise the government here, say lockdown should not be eased. Everybody should be told to go back indoors. You go down the in the same paper, the headlines are contradictory, confusing, disturbing. So that's why in the end, people are beginning to say, look, I can do this much or I can do this much. And so for some people, that is, I am still going to stay indoors. I'm going to wear a mask, going to be super careful. And other people are kind of, do you know what? It's time. I need to go and see my parents. I need to see my friends and I need to get my life back on track. And I think that is beginning to win through more and more.
Andrew, it's Rob. Hi. I'm curious as to what extent people are sort of, you know, at the verge of revolting in the UK. I mean, it's not a place that when I think of protests, I mean, I look across the United States, that's one form of violent protest. I look at France. I don't generally think of the UK as, I mean, you have big marches and things like that are generally peaceful. Are people outraged by, well, on the one hand, the restrictions, on the other hand, the fact that you have a key member of the government basically going against his own guidelines. Are we going to start to see some real unrest?
It's a strange moment, because I think that even people who are super critical of the government and who believe that Dominic Cummings broke every rule, they're still wary about being that vociferous about it. They still think that if you somehow unpick this sense of, you know, a national cause, then the whole thing will fall down and we will be left in a very difficult spot. So you see even people who say, I don't like this government, I believe it's been a disastrous manager, it's the PPE scandal rests with them, that the failure to lock down earlier rests with them. Even those people say, but let's not make this a political issue at the moment. We've got a healthcare system that is just back up and running properly. Let's not make too much of a fuss around it. So you don't see people going out on the streets to demonstrate. And here there's been a few demonstrations, but they are on the crankier far right side of things. You know, they're pure libertarians who they number a few hundred. But the revolt you're seeing is because they lost the narrative. You know, without dobbing people in, so people I spoke to over the weekend are like, oh, I went to stay at my sister's for the weekend. I know you're not meant to, but we went anyway. Or it's my mother's birthday, she's 90, but we went actually to see her because she's been on her own for too long. So I think in the last 10 days, something has happened because they've lost the narrative and people have decided, you know, I'm not going to go crazy and hold a rave in my house, but I will start seeing people. And that's the funny thing. And as I put in my column this week, that you're talking about contact with people. Twice this week, actually three times this week now, people have shook my hand instinctively. And yesterday we were with somebody who went and we went to say goodbye to them. Somebody I don't know hardly at all, but went to shake my hand and someone else said, oh, are you shaking hands? And he said, yes, let's start shaking hands again. If you're worried about it, you can go and wash them afterwards. Now, I think that people are just getting fed up of being told what to do in that sense, Rob.
Mm. Just on the handshaking point, Florian, you know, here as well, Andrew, there was something quite interesting happened with the Federal Council last week, and there's a very sort of complicated picture here now, which is, you know, 30 people could gather as of yesterday. So, you know, groups of 30 can get together in an informal setting and an impromptu setting. And then from next week, then we see numbers also will be increasing. And then that can be, of course, in let's say something which is completely prearranged. And the government got themselves in a bit of a muddle. What is impromptu? So if Rob sort of sent me a text to say I'm inviting you around for something in 2 hours, was that pre-planned or was that impromptu? Versus, you know, or if it was it a day in advance, is that still impromptu by Swiss standards? I don't know, where people like to plan in advance. Like maybe it is quite odd. Do you think it becomes very difficult for law enforcement? And it's not just a Swiss thing; it's a UK, it's worldwide. That as these measures start to lift, Florian, that it becomes quite unenforceable at a point.
I mean, a day in advance is definitely spontaneous for Swiss standards, right? No, but I mean, I think what we're struggling with is that you know, every government is taking different steps in order to get out of this lockdown. Every situation is somewhat differently, and to be very honest, I think nobody, even the best experts, can really predict with a certain degree of actual certainty what is going to happen. So we're living in a situation of a lot of uncertainty, and these rules and these guidelines, you know, groups of six in the UK, it was groups of five here, now it's 30, it's going to be 300 from next week on in Switzerland. So like, these are all pretty arbitrary numbers, right? Some of them are guided by science to a certain degree. Some of them are guided by sort of particular vested interests, I would say, of certain events, you know, having to have take place, and they just need a certain number of participants. Similarly, you know, the opening of borders across Europe was promised for 6th of July, which is the start of summer vacation. So there is all these things that now start to play in, and I think what's key here is that there has to be some sort of a trust between the government that has to take decisions without knowing for sure, and the people living in a country or a place that also have to take their daily decisions. You know, am I going to meet my mother or my granddad, or am I going to go out, have dinner with my friends now? All of these decisions, and nobody really knows, you know, what is considerate of others or what isn't, and what kind of degree of social interactions do we need to kind of live a good life, and what do we have to avoid in order not to harm others? And so I think this is kind of a constant trial and error, and it's a concept that we're not very comfortable with, and we have to figure out. And I feel, at least for the moment in Switzerland, it's going quite well. So, you know, I'm not actually thinking that the police will then actually go check on events, whether they've been announced a few hours early or a day early or so. It's kind of like this, it's a sort of a communication thing of, hey, maybe try not to overdo it and do it like blatantly wrong, and not try to play the system. And there's kind of a social contract in this that I think is very important. And I think for the moment, at least, I feel it's kind of working out in Switzerland.
Andrew, I have a bit of a concern. Next week, it's going to be 300 people can go out. That means discotheques are going to be opening in Switzerland as well. And I'm wondering sort of if Juliet, are you going to be able to come around the mic next Sunday morning?
I think not. Don't even ask.
Or is it going to be straight from the dance floor?
I'm going to be hungover. Yeah, no, well, absolutely.
And this is also the other problem right now is also, I mean, Andrew, I was talking to Jeremy King earlier in the week, and it seems like one of the sectors all over the world which really has trouble to properly kickstart in these times are restaurants. And we've seen sort of one picture, you know, which is coming out of this country, as we said, heard the news headlines. And Anne Hidalgo, mayor of Paris, is looking at maybe opening up pavements more as they've done here in Switzerland as well. So, Juliet, maybe just, you know, your first impressions talking to friends, how you're sort of seeing things. But Andrew, I also want to come to you in a second as well, as to just what you're hearing, because I mean, we're hearing maybe July, maybe even August in the UK for restaurants to potentially reopen. But how have you viewed it now, Juliet?
Well, to be honest, life really feels that it is back to normal in our world right now. I mean, clubbing aside, Tyler. But and I really feel that people have really let down their guard in Switzerland, almost worryingly so. A lot of the people I've talked to are saying everyone seems to have become too lax. I mean, I love the fact that we are given strong recommendations not to, as opposed to, as is verboten, you know. But we do, I was talking to a group of colleagues the other day, and we were saying we do get the feeling that nobody avoids you now in the street. In the supermarket, they'll just reach over you. Hardly anyone is wearing masks. I mean, honestly, at the supermarket now, I don't know about what your experience is, all of you, but I'm not seeing many of those at all. The disinfectant sort of lies there in the corner at the supermarket, not being used much.
But yeah, it still feels, despite all of the promotion for it, Andrew, it was interesting what you were saying in London, that you do see masks, but I mean, I think you commented on it when you were here. It's like, it still feels like it's around 1%. I mean, even though they're pushing it on the trams, I mean, 70%.
I don't see anybody wearing masks, to be honest. I mean,
we all have our designer masks. Not designer as in handmade or beautiful, but not a lot are pulling them out. So yeah, that's my impression. And I was wondering though, you know, Andrew, you were mentioning how the doom and gloomsters are saying, well, what's going to happen in winter? How can restaurants possibly keep a 2-meter distance in the winter? They're all going to go bust and everything. But don't forget, let me be a bit of an optimist here. The measures have moved so fast in Switzerland, for instance. So who knows whether there will be this spike in the winter, yes or no, but what about possibly no? And therefore, possibly restaurants won't have to keep the distances. And so maybe business will be picking up faster than we expect, and therefore faster than is expected in other countries where right now the situation still appears extremely dire.
I hope that's true on the restaurant front. If we do see the numbers continue to go down, then I think new people will just begin to again break the rules a little bit. But the first thing we need here is we need the city authorities to say, as they've said in Switzerland, as they've said, in, we heard in the news headlines there, they're saying in France, it's time for you to take over the pavement. You know, you can put more tables outside, you can expand to make money. We also have a problem here as shops begin to open it on the 15th. You know, can you imagine Oxford Street with a queue outside every single store, people waiting to get in? It's going to be slightly chaotic with the traffic still going through. They're saying it's going to be ticketed times to go into department stores. All of that, how on earth are they going to run all of that? So I think many people, we have a guy who runs a company here called Grind, a big coffee company who was on the Entrepreneurs this week, and he said, don't rush. Do not go and open your restaurant the minute you can. Wait and use all the money you can get from government and ride this thing out until you're confident that when you open that you can flourish, because otherwise you'll take on all the costs suddenly and you'll fail. So I think it's going to be very, very tricky. We have so many small restaurants that make their money by being packed all the time. I think it's going to be strange for many restaurants here in London.
Andrew, we're going to chat to you towards the end of the show. You can maybe reflect on some of the front pages that our gang here in Zurich is going to go through at the moment. And I'm going to probably assign this to Rob first. What has caught your eye on the world pages this morning?
Well, I certainly have a bias, which is towards thinking about what's going to happen next. So rather than focusing on the latest unrest in the United States or the Cold War that's pretty much kicked off into full fashion between the United States and China, I've been looking at some of the economic after effects, or how we're going to deal with this afterwards. And the NZZ here in Switzerland had a pretty interesting piece that analyzed what is essentially going to be an intergenerational wealth argument. I mean, where young people or younger people are going to be asked to pay for all of the expenses, for the increased debt, for all these other things that we've had to do as a result of the crisis, lots of government spending. There is no doubt that we're going to see more taxes. They're just going to be higher taxes. They're going to be different forms of taxes, and those will largely be paid for by working people in the prime of their working lives. And it's quite interesting. They showed a graph in the paper that basically showed over the last 10 years the way the wealth disparity between 55 to 69-year-olds and 40 to 54-year-olds. Now, I happen to fall within that latter category, so I'm particularly sensitive to it, but it suggests that you've had this move up for the baby boomers, as it were, who really have a greater and greater share of the assets. And this isn't just in Switzerland, this is in the United States, this is in Western Europe everywhere, and the United States. And now we're going to be asking, okay, folks, we've just spent $3 trillion on the CARES Act, the United States. The UK has spent hundreds of billions of pounds. You go $750 billion just this week in Europe, added to the other $2 trillion, I think, that's already in there. So all of this is going to – someone's going to have to pay for this. And I think it's really fascinating to think that through. Now, there are ways to do it. We haven't yet gotten to that point where, okay, guys, we know we're going to have to pay for it, but how are we going to do it? And how are we going to do this equitably? And it gets back to this question of, well, who did we really save? Whose lives were saved the most by essentially deciding to lock down economies, put people, mostly young people, out of work? Who was it? I mean, you're going to say, well, it was the average age or the median age of a fatality in Italy was 80. We are basically, we have decided that the young are going to take care of or keep the older from dying a little sooner than they would normally. I mean, it's essentially this giant economic trade-off. That, to me, is, and I also saw La Repubblica had a whole series from the Bank of Italy governor. Every year they do this thing where the Bank of Italy governor, it used to be the Bank of Italy, had control of the currency and the economy. Now, of course, they don't because they're part of the single currency. But still, it's a big deal when the Ignazio Visco comes out and says, okay, this is my view of the world, and all the great and good show up. In this case, 46 people were allowed in. And these pictures are extraordinary because you're used to seeing people packed into the gills. And you have them sitting like 6 feet apart, Mario Draghi in a mask up in the front. And basically he came up with similar, like, how is Italy going to deal with this? I mean, not only do we have a problem of how we pay for it, remember, they're the second most indebted developed nation in the planet, but, you know, he came up with seven different proposals, which I think were really quite fascinating. You know, everything from digitalization to infrastructure to human capital and that kind of thing. And, you know, I think this is the debate we're going to have to start having everywhere. Mm.
Florian, I don't want to sort of highlight the fact that you're in a slightly different age bracket than Rob or most of the people around this table. But anyway, we hear this as a discussion, and it's a talking point. Is it a talking point not just within your think tank and organization, but amongst your friends? Is this an area of concern if you are in a younger zone here in Switzerland?
Surprisingly, not so much, I must say. So I don't come across many conversations on this topic, although myself, I've been thinking quite a lot about it, because I think it is kind of the crucial, what Rob has said, it is kind of the crucial, redistribution behind this whole crisis. And I don't think we've given it enough attention. And I think if we don't, we're actually going to run into quite a lot of issues as a society in the future. And I just wanted to touch on one point. You know, Rob, you've mentioned we're certainly going to see more taxes, because somehow the governments need to get this money in to repay the money they've now raised on capital markets. And so I think, interestingly, there is kind of a window of opportunity there, I think, because, for example, if you look at the European Union, so these 750 million that you've mentioned, they're not going to be issued, sort of dispersed by issuing corona bonds, but they're actually going to go through the EU Commission, right? Mm. So that's a completely new thing. So now the Commission has some spending power. And the other side of the coin is, okay, so how are they going to get the money in? And so if you're thinking, you know, if there is on a European level, maybe also they're going to develop a way to actually raise taxes, but on a European level, then that opens opportunities for all this this talk about, you know, tax evasions, about how are we going to tax, you know, large digital corporations like Amazon and the likes. And I think there is a real opportunity there to think about our tax system in a more sort of comprehensive way, and have some interesting proposals going forward. That, you know, it's not just that we're spending more, but there is large opportunities in the globalized economy. How do we actually get the taxes in, and does it really make sense to tax labor all the time, or can we also tax different things that maybe make more sense also from an economic perspective?
So wealth,
I'm really looking, wealth would be one, but you know, these digital services would be another. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion, because I think that's actually the really interesting one, and from a systems perspective, the one that we need to have if we want to avoid, you know, like large unrest as we're seeing it kind of evolving in the US, for example, at the moment.
We're going to head to London for the news in a moment, but Juliet, maybe just one story from you that you've seen. I was also just thinking to Florian's point. I mean, what about a matcha latte tax for you? I mean, I think maybe you should just sort of, I mean, we're going to be able to actually see, you know, what are people spending the most on, what is most important to them? Why not whack an extra franc on, right? Anyway.
Then we'll all be flocking to Monocle to have our matches, nevertheless. No, well, I have a few pieces that
No, just time
to.
For one, because Emma's waiting. She's got news
well,
headlines.
Well, then you know what I'm going to do? I was looking at the Swiss papers, okay. And I'm actually going to talk to you about the two big page advertisements that are in the Sonntagszeitung. And they're both for the two cantons in Switzerland. So you've got Vaud, Canton Vaud advertising, full page. Forget about handshakes. We'll forgive you for that, and we just want to take care of you. And then on the next page, you've got Graubünden, and it says, finally, we've got these wide open, broad horizons, no more limitations anymore. Come and visit the biggest canton in the world. So isn't that interesting?
Yeah, they're all encouraging domestic tourism. I'm going there tomorrow.
Oh, you're just such a trend.
I know. Yeah, I'm off to Vals tomorrow. I was discussing.
But I've got more
Sven
to discuss after the break.
Very good. Emma Nelson is standing by in London with the news headlines.
Thank you very much indeed, Tyler. Curfews have been placed in cities across the US after violent protests over the death of George Floyd. President Donald Trump has announced he will start to end preferential treatment for Hong Kong in trade and travel. In Paris, the mayor Anne Hidalgo has said bars and cafes could partially reopen their outside spaces even further. And the Leaning Tower of Pisa has reopened to tourists again as part of Italy's gradual lifting of its lockdown. Those are the headlines on Monocle 24. Now back to you, Tyler, in Zurich.
Thanks, Emma. We're having a laugh back here saying, is Graubünden really the biggest canton in the world? Well, yeah, of course it is. Now, listen, if we could sort of open up any air route for you right now, Emma, where would you like to go the world?
Yeah. Right. Good Lord. I'm going straight to Italy. Straight for luncheon.
Oh, you're getting full thumbs up. Where should she go, Juliet?
Sicily or Sardinia?
You only got two choices, lines. Emma. She's only saying Sicily or Sardinia.
I'm not allowed to go to Sardinia because they've got no coronavirus, have they? And they've got this really difficult thing that they've got this very wonderful elderly population that cannot be touched by coronavirus. So via Rome, obviously, at lunch. Sorry, Juliet, I'm going to have to go to Rome first.
You've got to go and have an amatriciana in Rome, yes.
Absolutely. And then up to Verona, up to Garda for a bit, and then back down. I'm going on every plane I can now. I'm going to go to Sicily. I'm going to have to go to Sicily.
That's a very good choice.
Thank you. Am I right? Do I win?
Does she win?
Listen, if you're getting on a plane, you're a winner already. So,
but funny, Emma, that you should mention Sardinia, because you've got the governor, Christian Sorinas, precisely, who's kept it locked down, and he's succeeded. And he's a great, he's a great success story in Italy. But he himself did say that keeping the island isolated for much longer would be worse because the economy is now the sick patient of Italy. So even he is saying, okay, you've got to bring some sort of a certificate showing that you're negative. And I don't even want to open up that can of worms in Italy. About how there's going to be a whole black market of certificates.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're printing them now.
right? With a little M monogrammed on them. No, and so even Sardinia, possibly you could be heading there soon, Emma. This is my insider piece of advice to you. And Sicily, too. Okay, they're not going to quarantine anybody, but they also want your blood test results and they want traceability of visitors. But because the governor, Nello Musumeci, is saying we need to protect vacationers and contain the spread of the virus. But everyone is, of course, realizing that despite Greece shutting its borders to Italians, and there's a bit of a brouhaha about that, and Italians are all up in arms because they do have a lot of their citizens going to Greece on holiday. I do think that our islands are going to be available to vacationers.
It sounds to me, Emma, like you're going to be heading back up Lago di Garda way.
I'll be heading anywhere I can. Definitely Lago di Garda, because that's a place that's very dear to my heart. But the glorious thing is because I will have to quarantine for 14 days when I come back to the United Kingdom. So I may as well just never come home. I may as well just stick out there and see if we can set up a small broadcasting booth somewhere. So you can do radio from wherever you like
absolutely.
In the entire world.
I think maybe the Verona Bureau sounds very good. Emma, you're back in about 24 minutes time with the news headlines and more at the top of the hour. We should maybe head over to Hong Kong right now. Our Bureau Chief James Chambers is standing by. Good afternoon, James.
Good morning, Tyler.
I hear the buzz of street life below you, or just beyond the window. Paint a bit of a picture for us, because we were talking at the end of the week, obviously, about, of course, the announcement that we all saw coming down the track out of Beijing. Obviously, since then, we've of course had Trump coming out and talking about the recognition of special status is going to be out to the window. But let's just tell us what's happening out the window right now in Hong Kong.
It's been a very stormy weekend in Hong Kong on the streets, but that's more in a weather sense than any political unrest. The Hong Kong protests have become a bit unpredictable, and this weekend it's been extremely quiet out there. It's quite dry now, but there's no unrest on the streets. So, everyone's just kind of waiting to see how the activists here will react to the latest news.
And James, of course, you have experience being in the thick of it and certainly observing it. What is your bureau chief's take on how you think this certainly could play out, unravel over the days and weeks ahead?
Well, I think the announcement on Friday from Donald Trump was very light on detail. So he said he's going to revoke the special status and take some action on visas. But it seems like a lot of people have kind of shrugged their shoulders a bit and will wait to hear what that actually means, both in the US, in China, and in Hong Kong. I liked, there was one former advisor on Asia to Barack Obama described it as even if President Trump does it all, he does the very worst, it'll be the equivalent of shooting the hostage. but only in the leg. So, you know, and Hong Kong being the hostage in that analogy. So
we
it doesn't. none of this is helping Hong Kong, and the sad thing is it isn't hurting Beijing either, or certainly enough to deter them from taking any further action. I think one of the perhaps the disappointing things was the EU response on Friday, because they seem to be going their own way, and certainly wanting to stay buddy-buddy with China and not do anything that might get in the way of this EU-China summit in September in Leipzig. So at the moment, it's still very much US v. China. And as we've seen in the past, it will take a kind of a coalition of Western nations to have any impact on the way Beijing sees this. And so we're all looking forward to the G7 summit next month that the US will be hosting, to see what can come out of that.
Mm. James, I just want to bring in Rob here. Rob, you talked about obviously this, what is very much a Cold War, no matter how you sort of slice it or want to define it right now, between the U.S. And China. But when you look at Hong Kong, and maybe certainly from a news gathering perspective that we're all in, do you get any sense of demobilization, that people are thinking, okay, this is now the time to say, I've got to be, you know, back in Singapore. I need to maybe rethink and go to Seoul. Do I even say, look at let's just bite the bullet, we're going to go to Shanghai? Is there that type of rethink going on, or does, you know, Hong Kong still have the foundation, the base? Maybe not the connectivity right now, given just the way global air travel is. But, you know, again, we move beyond this, and it still has to be there, and still has its role within APAC and globally.
Yeah, I'd say yes. It actually, we're now in contingency planning mode. I mean, I don't have like a plan, but we're starting to say, okay, what do I do when, let's say, I have a journalist that wants to be based in Asia, who has family, and they have a choice potentially of going to Singapore or Tokyo. I mean, now it's not the same. You're covering China is the story. How do you cover China? You cannot do it as effectively in Singapore, certainly not as effectively in Sydney. And you don't even know China exists if you're in Tokyo. And I think this is a real fundamental problem we have. But we're, you know, for my business, we're going to be focusing on where the money goes, right? So if all the US investment banks and European investment banks and the UBS and Morgan Stanley's and people like that start to say, well, we're going to put our head of APAC in Tokyo or in Sydney or in Singapore, we're going to have to start rethinking that. But in 20 years of essentially running a team that has folks in Hong Kong, I don't think I've ever come this close to having to have those discussions, to actively be discussing with the Reuters HR department what we might do, how this might work. And I think it's sad to me, because I've always thought of as Hong Kong was this, just as you say, it was the connective tissue in many respects. Now it's, you know, people say it's like easy Asia, you know, whatever. That's like the joke from the old China hands. And it's true, because you can live a life with essentially the similar freedoms that you have in a London or New York, but you are still connected to the tissue of China. Putting people in Shanghai, first of all, it's not like I can just decide that. I have to get these special visas. I have to go through the Ministry of Communications, or, you know, it's a complete pain in the you know what. Mm. Putting people in Singapore. Remember, not that many years ago, that Singapore was suing the Wall Street Journal. Like, we have so these issues around press freedoms and that kind of thing. They're going to come up everywhere, but. Yeah, I think it's quite sad, and I'm quite worried for the sort of status of Hong Kong as this bastion of sort of, you know, essentially freedom in Asia.
James, just before we go, is that the conversation at the Foreign Correspondents Club? Do you get a sense? I mean, look, you know, you've got the New York Times, the big operation, AP. I mean, everyone operates significant bases out of Hong Kong. Are people hedging their bets? And even just from a peer set group, do you hear from friends and colleagues that, yeah, people are upping sticks and looking, at least looking elsewhere anyway?
Well, yeah, that's the favorite talking point right now. But as Rob says, where do you go? I mean, Ho Chi Minh City, that's a nice place, but it's under a communist government. In Seoul, you might get bombed by the North. In Taipei, let's not kid ourselves, that's going to be next on China's hit list. And as Rob said, Singapore is a quasi-authoritarian city-state anyway. I mean, there's more freedom of speech in Hong Kong than there is in Singapore.
And don't talk about the king if you go to Bangkok.
Exactly, yes. So it is a talking point. But I mean, I think the dirty secret in Hong Kong right now is actually the business community may actually be able to find themselves getting comfortable with this, because what they want to see is stability here, and they want to still continue making money. So we'll see how this plays out. But as long as, you know, the US banks don't become the next target, then they'll find a way of being able to get comfortable with this. And the tycoons have all come out in support of it. The worrying thing is whether China will use a similar tactic to what they were doing in Australia. They can't take on the US directly, so they're going to pick on its smaller allies. And there was a story, you know, just as this stuff broke on Friday, where the former chief executive, CY Leung, started questioning HSBC's role in China and Hong Kong, and how much money it makes over here, and why it hadn't come out to support the security bill. So I can see China, you know, going after the UK as a way of getting at the US.
James Chambers in Hong Kong. We're going to have to leave it there, but have a very good week. Florian, time for you to grab a story off one of the front pages. What's caught your eye this morning?
So my front page this morning is online. So I've grabbed a story from Swiss online magazine République, which talks about supporting the media. So it's actually quite interesting because Switzerland has always fared a very liberal approach, and it was never a discussion, you know, to what extent the state should actually support media. But now during Corona times, this has become extremely sort of an issue that was debated quite hotly, because the parliament session was suspended, so there was kind of a quite widespread fear of how democratic control is actually working, and the media kind of stepped in and therefore became a more prominent role. So we're talking about subsidies here. So we're talking about subsidies for printed paper delivery. I don't even know how relevant that is anymore.
It's very relevant, let me tell you. But anyway, that's another program.
So that's about 50 million a year that the government is willing to spend on just subsidizing the actual delivery of printed papers. But the more interesting thing, I think, is for the first time, they're actually talking about introducing subsidies for online media, and that subsidy is going to be degressive. So that means the less revenues you make as an online media outlet, the more you get. So for each Swiss franc that you're making in revenue, you can get a maximum of 80 cents of government subsidies, which is quite a lot. So that would effectively double your revenue almost, if you're a small, you know, online media outlet. And that might come with the strings attached that native ads are ruled out. So you're not allowed to actually kind of do, you know, sort of paid for reporting and then, you know, not actually disclosing that it's an ad very prominently. So that's all going to be in Parliament in June. And I think it's quite interesting because we're talking about kind of new media models and new ways of actually transmitting information and kind of the government trying to keep this sector, you know, thriving without taking control over content. So yeah, I think that's an interesting development to watch. I'm not sure where other countries stand on this front, but for Switzerland at least, that's very new.
Absolutely. I mean, you have seen it popping up in other European countries as well. You know, part of course, is the big fight against big digital and what that means, certainly off the back of also a story which is very hot right now about Microsoft getting rid of journalists, going completely AI in some areas, which is, we sort of saw that one coming down the track, but we'll shake our heads about that, and we will devote all of that to maybe another program. You are listening to Monocle on Sunday. It's just 10:47 here in Zurich. We're coming back right after this. Are listening to Monocle on Sunday from Zurich with me, Tyler Britt. Now, our June issue is out now, and on its pages, we hear from 50 thinkers from across industries about their thoughts on what we've learned from the COVID-19 outbreak and what happens next. One of the essays is by Monocle 24's executive producer, Tom Edwards, who has written about why radio matters so much in times like these. Let's have a listen.
Who do you trust in a crisis? Throughout the pandemic, there's been a real premium on media outfits able to track reliably the development of the disease and the vicissitudes of global governments' reactions. Where to find those newsrooms that have managed to reflect legitimate concerns while offering much-needed perspective, satisfying curiosity without succumbing to the hyperbole of the strident anchor or the wearying pace of the news ticker? In pursuit of a new source that resonates, the chances are that you turned on your radio. In turbulent times, people need voices they can trust, sure, but they also need a sense of connection, particularly when we're all socially distanced. Radio is delivering this togetherness emphatically. Even by conservative estimates, markets such as the US and UK experienced a 15% plus uplift in live listening in the earliest days of the outbreak. This is something of a rejoinder to the idea that podcast-powered non-linear listening has ended the primacy of live. And it's happening because, if it's done right, radio offers something no other medium can deliver. A spellbinding combination of immediacy, intimacy, and humanity. It was a lesson I learned long ago, sometime during the latter part of the first Reagan administration. That might seem a curious marker for a Londoner, but it might make more sense if I explain that it was when I heard Alastair Cook's peerlessly brilliant Letter from America for the first time. Cook's long-running broadcast was a fixture on BBC Radio 4, and formerly on the Home Service, although this correspondence recall doesn't stretch back quite that far, for almost 60 years until 2004. Every one of the nearly 3,000 episodes recorded over that period was presented by Cook. I couldn't tell you which one caught my attention, but I know to this day why it worked. It was the craft of his writing, the gentleness of his humour, and the warmth and honesty of his delivery that made me take notice and, dare I say it, trust what he had to say. If the pandemic changes anything irreversibly, let's hope that it's the emotional investment we put into our media. Here's to less airtime for the voices that shout loudest, fewer eyeballs on clickbait and journalism, and on spurious or downright dangerous platforms spreading little but discord and disinformation. More power, instead, to a medium that's reacted to an unprecedented global crisis by reasserting its credentials as the truest form of what I consider a genuinely social media. The voice in your ear that can reassure and cajole, inform and entertain, and, who knows, perhaps even inspire. For Monocle, I'm Tom Edwards.
And you can find Tom's essay and 49 others at least in our new June issue, which should be dropping through letterboxes. Florian, to your point, this is why we need things to be delivered. Maybe we don't need subsidies, but we certainly need to get magazines around the world. And for all of our listeners right now as well who haven't received their issue, please bear in mind that there are a few logistical log jams happening around the world at the moment. Andrew Tuck is standing by in London. Julie, I wanted to ask you, though, just a reflection on radio. When you were growing up, what was it, sort of a radio memory?
Oh, gosh, funny. What, you should ask.
Okay.
I also grew up with the BBC World Service in Rome, constantly on the radio, and Letter from America. It was a great highlight. I absolutely remember Alastair Cook. Now, of course, I was very, very young at the time, as you will imagine. But no, so, and I've also worked both in radio and in TV. And it has to be said that there is that immediacy to radio that you get far more than with television.
And also with radio, you can wear your Lululemon on air and no one's going to know,
which
right?
You're clearly wearing, but I'm not this morning. But it is nice, can we say it, compared to those good old days when we would just have the little crackly on, that it is nice that if you do miss a show, you can go online and you can find it and you can listen to the Monocle podcast you might have missed this morning because you were out swimming in the lake.
Correct. Rob, what did you grow up with on the dial, and what's part of your daily or weekly audio dial at the moment?
Well, aside from FM radio, which was sort of, you know, my adolescence, classic rock in Connecticut was, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd on a Sunday morning. But I would say it's really funny. I was just listening to that essay and what you were just saying, Julia. My parents would always have NPR, and they would always play Alastair Cook's Letter from America. And, you know, even though I was in America, in many ways, it instructed me in sort of what a good foreign correspondent does. And that's actually guided my career in many respects. I hadn't thought about it. I'm actually getting, like, goosebumps thinking actually Alastair Cook, you know, was in many ways an inspiration for me. And to this day, when I think about as a foreign correspondent, you know, that ability to kind of he was actually speaking not just to you in Rome or you in Canada or anywhere else or in the UK. He was actually speaking to people in the United States at the time who wanted to have some introspective analysis of their own country. And I think certainly in a moment like today, that would be pretty useful.
Florian.
In terms of radio, I think I still remember FM time. So I also remember these, you know, pre-podcast and pre-internet times. I don't think I grew up with a lot of sort of very intellectually savvy radio programs. I remember listening to the Swiss Hit Parade every Sunday, which, you know, plays down the 50 top songs back in the times when you could actually measure a CD
that
sales.
That was with what,
you know?
Sven Epine or
yeah,
someone,
it right? It's like, you know, it's completely tasteless music.
DJ Bobo.
Really, yeah, DJ Bobo was prominent on there, you know. Very, very bad example of probably how not to do radio. But yeah, that's kind of the one that stuck because, you know, I used to have these tape recorders, and then whenever a song came up that you really liked,
hit record.
4 seconds
right?
In.
Early pirates.
So you basically put together what you now is your Spotify playlist, but manually on a Sunday afternoon for like 3 hours, you know, listening through all the moderation and all the ads. So that was my radio, I think, memory from back in the days.
Andrew, you was it the wireless on the kitchen window? Windowsill? Was it in the car driving around the zones west of London? What was it for you?
Well, we had a car radio that was a disaster. It was always tuning in and out of stations. It had more static on it than you can imagine. So I don't have many good memories of listening to the radio driving. Oddly, it always worked when you got home. My dad used to come home from work and he was always listening to something intently. And you'd see his car park, you'd be excited a bit when you were a kid to see him come in the house. And he'd just sit in the car for another like 15 minutes, finishing off a show before he'd come in the house. But I have exactly the same memories of like with pop music, trying to, you know, record the charts on a tape, that then get eaten up by the tape machine some few days later. So it's always a wasted effort. So I don't look back sadly on those days.
I think Emma Nelson is also there as well. Emma, was there an inspiring voice that made you think, look, I want to be reading the news or out in the world as a correspondent?
I think it was anybody who made you realize that you're talking to one person. I think the most important thing that you've got to remember with radio is that you listen to it when you're on your own. So you're inviting someone who is your best friend, a confidant, to take you somewhere really important and really exciting. So anybody who could do that for me. But what I find now is that the radio has become such a domestic battleground. I don't know what it was like growing up in your household, but my mum would want to listen to one thing. My dad would want to be sideswiped by some beautiful music. I just want to listen to something awful on the charts with my press record pause thing. And that same thing has now happened with my world, that I'm flitting between radio stations depending whether I want news or music or to be transported somewhere else. And my son just wants local London capital pop music, and it has just become an element of torture. And so I'm now sort of like fighting against this constant stream, albeit I quite like The Weeknd and Bruno Mars, but not all day, and certainly not at 5:30 in the morning. So it's just that feeling that the radio is this magical place, but boy, it can give you a headache.
But isn't there something to be said, but also a gathering and a rallying point, around one conversation, as opposed to everyone sort of, you know, being, you know, in the apartment, you know, on your boat, wherever you are, listening to their own thing.
Well, yes, that's the thing. Nowadays, you know, even the kids, do you remember when we used to sit by the radio hoping that your favorite song would come on, but you didn't know if it was or weren't? You would just say, well, now they just go, oh, YouTube, oh, put in the name, you've got to spell it right. But that's just because
not even,
Emma's
but
son
anyway.
Is the same age as mine. But, and then, bang, they've got it. And I feel that we were so much more patient.
And absolutely.
Absolutely. We didn't have 10 radios in the house, and you did have to wait your turn. True. Yeah.
Andrew, maybe we're going to be doing a series of discussions and debates. I think we've talked about one show about risk, but maybe a show about patience would be good as well, no?
Very good. The other thing we had as when we were young, we had a bush radio that had on the dial. There's a big dial.
I wouldn't even ask you what a bush radio is, but anyway, that's...
But it encouraged you to believe that if you spun the dial, you might be able to hear Moscow. It literally said on the dial, Moscow. But I don't think you ever got to hear anything from Moscow either.
Yeah, and there was always Luxembourg there as well because of Radio Luxembourg in its moment in time.
And Radio Vatican, remember that?
Don't forget Radio Vatican. Andrew, just very quickly, in about 15 seconds, what are we looking forward to this week on your schedule?
Well, we're reporting the July-August issue, and we're reflecting the conversation we've had today. The cities are opening up, people are getting back out there. So it's going to be an issue about, you know, celebrating summer in the city.
Excellent. Emma Nelson, back in London, just very quickly, what's coming up next in 15 seconds?
Coming in 15 seconds, we have I'll be giving you the latest world news, and we'll be having some music, and Andrew will be hearing your bulletin from this weekend that you have very kindly and politely and brilliantly read out loud for us. We'll be playing all that in the next hour, and we'll have Monocle in Culture in an hour, when we'll be talking about the survival of the music press in the pandemic.
Very good. Well, I can say that that Rob Cox is hosting a barbecue for 30 people, and we're all heading there shortly, just very spontaneously for any Swiss authorities who are listening. I think so.
Okay.
Maybe not. Who knows? My thanks to Rob Cox, Juliet Lindley, James Chambers, and Andrew Tucker. Producer back in London was Marcus Hippie, studio manager in Zurich, Sven Mikos, and Nora Holt in London. I'm Tyler Boulay in Zurich. Have a very nice Sunday. Goodbye.